been a long time coming. But tonight, because of what we did on this day, in this election, at this defining moment, change has come to America.
Suzanne Goldenberg, and I'm at the Mayflower Hotel in Washington, where Democrats are holding their official victory party for Barack Obama. There are celebrations like this all over Washington and in many American cities. It's Wednesday, November 5th, and this is a special edition of Guardian Daily. We'll be looking at the historic win of Barack Obama and the stinging defeat for John McCain.
My friends, we have come to the end of a long journey. The American people have spoken, and they have spoken clearly.
I'm John Dennis in London. As the Republican Party faces up to a crushing defeat, we'll be asking how the result will be seen around the world. And we'll be looking at the issues facing the 44th President of the United States as he seeks to put the Bush years behind him.
There is a bulging, gigantic in tray full of stuff for the next president to tackle on minute one.
When the tiny hamlet of Dixville Notch declared in favour of Obama by 15 votes to 6, it set the pattern for the night. State after state fell to Obama, safe Democratic havens such as New York and California. But when Pennsylvania, then Ohio, and astonishingly the former Confederate state of Virginia turned blue, it was game over for McCain, and an end to the Republicans' 8-year grip on the White House.
CBS News, I'm Harley Carnes. This is history. CBS News now estimates the end of the race. California, Oregon, Washington, and Hawaii are estimated to go to Barack Obama when the votes are totaled. And those states put him over the 270 electoral votes needed to become the first African-American president of the United States.
And there you see flashbulbs popping, American flags in the breeze, and people jumping up and down, applauding and yelling with joy that their man, Barack Obama, a hometown boy, at least an adopted hometown boy, has been elected the 44th president of the United States.
This is truly an incredible moment of American history. I can't think of another country in the world where you would have a significant minority that was once so maligned and so oppressed finally have one of its sons rise to this level.
Senator McCain, who watched the results come in from his home state of Arizona, conceded the race in a gracious speech.
We fought as hard as we could, and though we fell short, the failure is mine, not yours. I don't know what more we could have done to try to win this election. I'll leave that to others to determine. Every candidate makes mistakes, and I'm sure I made my share of them. But I won't spend a moment of the future regretting what might have been.
But today, it's all about one man.
And to those Americans whose support I have yet to earn, I may not have won your vote tonight, but I hear your voices. I need your help, and I will be your president too. And all those watching tonight from beyond our shores, from parliaments and palaces, to those who are huddled around radios in the forgotten corners of the world, our stories are singular, but our destiny is shared. And a new dawn of American leadership is at hand.
Barack Obama's astonishing ability to mobilize the vote has led to the biggest turnout in decades. In some places, people queued for hours to have their say. Once the final tallies are made, the turnout is expected to top 130 million. That's the biggest since 1960. Suzanne, give us a sense of the scale of this victory.
Well, this is a historic victory on two counts. Of course, Barack Obama is America's first black president, but he's also won on a very big scale across the country, racking up Democratic victories in the South, in the West, and in the industrial heartland in a way that we have not seen for very many years. Well, I'm back in the Guardian's Washington office, where we've spent a long night reporting as the results came in, and I'm joined by my colleague, Ewan McCaskill. Ewan, talk us through the results in more detail. How big a win is this?
Well, the biggest gain for Barack Obama was simply holding on to the Democratic states that were won in 2004, but expanding into the Republican heartland. The first big result of the night was when he held on to the Democratic state, Pennsylvania. John McCain had spent most of his resources trying to flip Pennsylvania. That was his one and only strategy. He thought if he could flip Pennsylvania, he could win the election. I think it was a fairly desperate strategy to begin with, and it just didn't work out. Then came the two key results of the night. The first was Ohio. It's long been the sort of swing state, the Midwest, traditional barometer of opinion in America. And it seemed to be fought pretty closely throughout the campaign. But on the night, it went fairly easily to Obama. And then the one that the Democrats and liberals around the world will love is Florida, the sort of sense of revenge for 2000. Bush took it in contentious circumstances in 2000, still a debate on whether he rightfully took it or not. The Democrats got the revenge tonight when McCain was soundly beaten in Florida and it went Democratic.
Well, earlier on, I went along to the official Democratic Victory Party here in Washington, where people were in an ecstatic mood.
I'm an Obama supporter. I was home in my apartment watching the returns in my pajamas, and I said, I have to be a part of this. And I got dressed, and they let me in. They gave me a band, and it's great to be a part of history. I feel like this is a really big part of history, and it's fantastic to be here.
What for you is the most moving part of this? You say it's historic. What is historic exactly?
I think that an Afro-American is getting elected, that it's somebody who I think will bring change to the country, that we need change, that the way that he campaigned, the campaign that he ran, just the future for the country I feel is very bright, and I'm very excited about it.
I think his election will restore confidence in the government, and confidence, and what we have right now is a confidence crisis. And I think what he brings is a restoration of that, and it will help us to move forward.
I'm Fred Grigsby. I'm from California.
And what brings you here tonight?
This.
And for you, what does this night mean? What does it symbolize?
Oh, it's very significant. It's a total transformation of, I think, not only the United States, but I think it will be very impactful in the whole world in terms of representing an opportunity to be judged on your merit.
Did you have, I guess in these last few days, did you begin to have that sort of Democratic nervousness and doubt that he could pull it off, that he would do it?
No, it's been looking good since the middle of September, really. Once the economy got into the picture, I think it was pretty well certain that he was going to end up on top. He is clearly a leader of a lifetime.
So, Ewan, let's go back and talk about the business of voting. How bad were the lines out there today? What kind of waits did people encounter?
Well, to be quite honest, it went fairly smoothly. I mean, there were lots of expectations that, there's new voting machines that would go badly. There'd be lots of challenges from, and particularly the Republicans, especially in sort of African American areas. Most of these things didn't happen. Given the scale of the election, so many people descending on the polls at the same time, it went very smoothly. The voting machines, for the most part, worked. There were relatively few legal challenges. And I think it was to America's credit that it went as smoothly as it did.
Now, you've talked about John McCain pursuing a desperate strategy here that didn't work for him. How big a loss is this now for the Republicans? How do they come back from this?
Well, I think a lot of Republicans never thought much of McCain's chances anyway. And a lot of Republicans don't like McCain in the first place. They don't regard him as basically a Republican. He's too much of a sort of maverick, as he likes to portray himself, for that. He's voted against the Republican line and Bush's line too often. So what we're going to see now is a very intense period over months and probably years of soul-searching by the Republican Party. They've got a huge issue to deal with. They have to analyse why they lost this election. Was it because they were too far to the right? Or as a lot of Republicans believe, that they weren't right-wing enough? If the conclusion that a lot of Republicans come to is that they weren't right-wing enough, then they're going to be out of power for a long time to come. The part of the problem is that the rump of the Republican Party is, for the most part, fairly right-wing and conservative. They're the conservatives that like Sarah Palin, and the sort of more moderate ones are the ones that have either lost their seat or are sort of alienated by, feel alienated by the Bush administration. And so I think the Republicans are in for a period in the cold that will last certainly for the next couple of years.
Guardian Daily, news and reports from around the world.
I'm John Dennis in London. Also in this special edition of Guardian Daily, we'll be hearing from diplomatic editor Julian Borgia on how the rest of the world will see this victory.
This is transformational in the way that America will be seen across much of the third world. And don't forget, this is a president whose middle name is Hussein.
In his first speech as president-elect, Obama addressed an adoring crowd in Chicago. It's the place where he cut his teeth as a community organiser. The Guardian's Jonathan Friedland was there.
Police estimate now around 125,000. Some people think it's more. A huge park stretched and filled with this carpet of people jammed in. And hugely emotional scenes. I mean, first of all, obviously cheering and waving flags and holding up signs saying, yes, we can. But many, many people in the crowd, when it first came through, one victory after another, Pennsylvania, then Ohio, is it became clearer and clearer that he was going to win. People turning to each other, hugging, embracing, and many of them sobbing. I spoke to one woman, an older woman, who had marched in Selma, Alabama, saying, and this was a phrase so many people have used today, that they had never thought they would see this day. And they cannot help but get very, very emotional as they describe that. And I think that was the kind of crowd that Barack Obama walked into, really. People who see his victory as tremendously emotional and important in their own lives.
Barack Obama, not for the first time, really captured the mood.
He did. It was a remarkably gracious speech, I think, in the sense he reached out to those people who he had defeated. He was very generous towards John McCain. I don't think anyone was surprised by that. But he was even, I think, giving a hint of what kind of unifying role he wants to play, the kind of consensus he wants to build as president by praising the founding ideals of the Republican Party, saying those are ideals we all share and that we need in America, and talking about those whose votes I have not yet won. I need your help in building the country. But also a somberness, a sobriety about how he spoke. Really as if he is a leader in an extraordinarily difficult period. And people have been comparing and mentioning FDR, Franklin Roosevelt, and there was something of that sort of sobriety about the speech. It wasn't a sort of rah-rah, we've won the election, victory rally type speech at all. It was actually the first speech of his presidency, and suggesting that he understands the burden of leadership that has now fallen on his shoulders.
He did also acknowledge, though, that he embodies an America where all things are possible.
Very much aware that the huge symbolism of an African-American president, invoking Martin Luther King, talking about the 106-year-old woman who voted today in Atlanta, Georgia, who had been barred the vote, first because she was a woman and also because she was the colour of her skin. And seeing, I think, not making it central to his message, but seeing his remarkable victory as part of that spectrum, that continuum that goes back to, yes, Martin Luther King, but even earlier, invoking and mentioning the Civil War. He understands the enormity of this in the span of American history and the notion that this is something of the very best of America that his election embodies, because it has shown that actually a country can overcome its own prejudices and its own racial wounds and do something which most countries like America with an ethnic minority have not done, which is to elect a non-white leader. It's a remarkable day, and he, I think, understands entirely the the historic nature of it and his place in it.
Jonathan Friedland in Chicago. Well, John McCain conceded defeat in Phoenix, Arizona. Our correspondent there is Dan Glaister.
It's called the McCain-Palin 2008 election night event, which is a rather flat title. Frankly, that's the mood, particularly the mood now. I mean, the guy just conceded and, yeah, flat, disappointed, surprised, dejected. Surprised because people here were really kept in the dark. Unless they were on their cell phones, the people watching TV somewhere, they really didn't know what was going on outside this room, which was quite strange. You know, there was a moment when the Pennsylvania result flashed up on one of the big screens here, only for that screen suddenly to go dark, just as the word Pennsylvania appeared. And then from that moment on, really, there was no news in this room. It was a succession of country and western covers bands. Hank Williams Jr. played a couple of sets. You know, it was that sort of thing. But to be honest, the mood was not celebratory at the beginning of the evening. You know, it was people were all dressed up, they were all in their finest frocks and, you know, Sunday best and that sort of thing, but it never felt like a celebration.
McCain was gracious in defeat, though.
Yeah, I think for the people here, when they look back on that speech in a couple of days, and yes, they would agree with you. And yeah, I mean, I certainly agree. It was a very generous, gracious speech. And actually, in a way, a fairly brave speech, because he sort of confronted a lot of his supporters, I would think. He was talking about prejudice, he was talking about race and, you know, the breaking of barriers. And the first time he mentioned Obama in his speech, the boos that have become the standard of the last days and weeks of the campaign. And he moved swiftly to stop that. And then he sort of explained, you know, I don't suppose he had a script because, you know, I think he can think on his feet. But he moved to stop that and then went on to explain what he meant and how, what the importance and significance of the victory of an African-American candidate in a presidential election was in this country. And the same when, you know, he mentioned Joe Biden, and then there was big boos again. And again, he moved to stamp on that. I mean, it's fine to do that now. Perhaps he might have done a bit more of that when it was being raised during the campaign.
Forty-five years after Martin Luther King's famous civil rights speech in Washington, America has elected a black president. For the 37 million African Americans in the US, it's a defining moment. In the predominantly black district of Harlem in New York City, there was jubilation at the local headquarters of the Obama campaign, where activists and those who had simply voted for the senator gathered to celebrate.
It's indescribable, but it's like the colors of the rainbow. Everyone came together as one. The unity, the love, the admiration, the one, everyone on one accord, it's been phenomenal. You know, it's indescribable. I mean, the love, and it just, I don't know, it's just beautiful. It's just beautiful.
No, this is not my first one. I've campaigned in most of the elections there. I've even met Martin Luther King at the age of 11, and so I know what the struggle is, what this all means there. It's for the Fannie Lou Hamers there, the Goodwin Shermans, and that got murdered, the Mega Evans that got murdered for the right to vote there. Hey, this is a new day there. This is, they're probably looking up and looking down from heaven there with tears in their eyes there, smiling or whatnot.
It means a lot to me. This is big time to me. This is big time. This is one of those events that will probably be recorded in history along with the major events of history. It won't just be an American president. It won't just be an American president, a historical cycle being completed by the election of an American president. It will probably rank with, Obama's name will probably go down in history with the great names, Martin Luther King, Mahatma Gandhi.
God, I mean, I'm glad it happened in my lifetime, in my grandmother's lifetime, my grandfather's, like, they're both alive to participate in it. It's like, I don't even know how to describe it.
What does it mean to you?
It means everything to me. Like, I woke up this morning and I wanted to take my son with me to go voting, but he was, like, out of it. But as soon as I came home, I was like, you know what today is? He's like, I know, it's election day. I'm like, you know what's going on? Barack Obama? He's like, I know, Barack Obama's gonna be president. I'm like, we're hoping, we're praying. I've been hyped all day.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's comprehensive coverage on The Guardian's website today, including the results, how the election was won state by state. We've also got video. Michael Tomasky gives his take on the election. Gary Young reports from Barack Obama's hometown of Chicago. And our blogger in residence, Oliver Berkman, offers his 25 highlights of a long and frankly gruelling campaign. All that at guardian.co.uk/America.
It'll be 2 months before President-elect Obama comes here in Washington to take up the reins of power. After 8 years of the George Bush presidency, the talk throughout this campaign from both candidates was all about change. But what will that change actually look like? And what are the issues facing the new president? The Guardian's Ilana Shor reports on what's waiting in the Oval Office for President Barack Obama.
So I'm standing here in front of the White House. Gorgeous, Greek-columned building, very pristine, but inside, it's chaos. There is a bulging, gigantic in-tray full of stuff for the next president to tackle on minute one. Let's run through what President Obama has got to get done with straight away. Issue number one, economy. We just passed a $700 billion banking bailout, $250 billion more dollars in direct investments, so that's more than $1 trillion in new debt. Homeowners have gotten no aid, so the first thing Obama is going to have to do is say, well, how do I help people in foreclosure who are losing their homes, when the Republicans are still allied against helping any homeowners directly, and my own party is screaming for a pretty liberal solution, but I can't afford to be that liberal. So Obama is going to have to thread the needle, as we say. I mean, he's a compromiser. He likes to sell himself as a pragmatist, but he doesn't have much money to work with, and he's got to create a new program for the economy. Issue number two is Iraq and Afghanistan. You didn't hear much about it on the campaign trail while the credit crisis was raging, but it's serious. We're going to have, when Obama takes office, 136,000 troops in Iraq. He's promised to draw them down, but he's also promised to grow the size of the military because we need more troops in Afghanistan. There we've got just about 33 or 34,000. Where will these new troops come from? The military, our advisors are telling us, is almost broken. And the Bush administration is telling Obama, you need a plan before January. Number three, energy and the environment. That's something you heard a lot about on the campaign trail, when petrol prices were through the roof in America. Now they've gone down a little bit, enough that energy use has actually fallen. But Obama is going to have to keep the nation interested in renewables. In the U.S., people love their oil and they love their gas guzzlers to this day. So Obama is going to have to sell a program of energy conservation and clean sources. The U.S. is the biggest total energy user in the world, 100 quadrillion British thermal units of energy last year alone. So this is a huge mandate for him. And then once you add to that education, healthcare, veterans benefits, college loans, I don't envy Obama. Those inaugural parties are going to be fun, but he's going to have to get to work pretty quickly.
Ilana Shor. Now, Guardian columnist Martin Kettle has joined you and McCaskill and me in our Washington office. Martin, how is Obama going to manage all of this? Can he manage all of it? And are the expectations too high for him?
I think the expectations are stratospheric amongst his supporters. We're sitting here and we can hear outside, I don't know if you can pick it up on the mics, the celebratory car horns as the parades go around in the middle of the Washington night. There's a real sense of ebullience here, which you don't normally get. So there's huge expectations, plus the fact that not only is there Democratic President Obama, but a Democratic Congress now. We don't know the final figures quite yet, but clearly in a position to deliver if they can agree on priorities and an agenda. An immensely strong position for Obama. So, you know, that all adds to expectations. How will it actually pan out? I think at the moment, everything is going to have to be sacrificed to the financial imperatives. That's the number one issue. You heard Obama talking about that more and more as Election Day neared. And I think that the transition team will be in the Treasury Department this week with Hank Paulson's team, trying to fashion a way through that. I think that is going to be his number one priority. At the same time, that may not be the thing that the ranks of the party really want to him to prioritise. I mean, you know, Iraq, Afghanistan, healthcare, these are things which Democrats have been longing for a generation, in the case of healthcare, and for several years in the case of a withdrawal from Iraq. So he's going to be on an immense pressure on all of those fronts.
And if he can't deliver on the economy, what then? What happens to all the sounds of celebration we're hearing now?
Well, this is probably the best day of his life, and it never gets any better than it does on the day you've been elected. And of course, the old saw has it in American politics, just as in British politics, that the next election campaign begins on day one after the last one. So, you know, he's got to be thinking about what he's going to do to get re-elected in 2012 already. So he's got to decide which of the achievements that he's really going to have on his, so he's got to decide, you know, what are his priorities? What's he going to go to the country on in 4 years' time? I think that in a very volatile political and economic situation like you've got at the moment, with expectations high, whatever goes up can come down, and you know, you have to the cycle of politics could go very long in the Democrats' favor over a very long period of time now, but it could go very short, and you know, that's what part of the fascination of the next few years is all going to be about.
Ewan, let's have a look at the congressional races. What has happened to Congress, and what does the new power balance in Congress now mean for Obama and what he can do?
The Democrats managed to, partly on the back of Obama's popularity and partly just antipathy towards the Republicans, they managed to extend the number of seats in both the House and in the Senate. So you have the Democrats in one of the most solid, powerful positions they've been in Washington for a very long time. Control of the White House, control of Congress, and maybe in a position to alter the makeup of the Supreme Court. But having control of Congress and the White House, while on the face of it seems like quite a good idea, that Obama should be able to push through legislation, although, as Martin says, given the economic situation, his options are limited. But there's a downside to having a Congress that's Democrat when you've got a Democratic incumbent in the White House. They'll make demands on Obama that he won't necessarily want to deliver on. There'll be people who are possibly to the left of him and people who are to the right of him who will want to push through legislation that the White House won't like. There'll be people who will say that Obama is too much in thrall of people in Congress, that he's not strong enough leader, he's too inexperienced, he's listening too much to the congressional leaders, Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi. So you can see problems.
I just want to add to that, I mean, in any election like this, you have this phenomenon of coattails, where sometimes the presidential candidate carries other candidates to victories which they would not otherwise win. But you also have the other phenomenon, which is of candidates in congressional elections doing exceptionally well in places where the presidential candidate didn't do so well. And, you know, politics is a hardball game. And the candidates who have won without Obama, as it were, who have done better than Obama in their states, will not feel under any particular obligation to him, whereas the ones who have come in because of Obama will clearly feel under an obligation to him. It's quite a complicated nexus, and the way it works out over the next few months, I think, is going to be incredibly interesting, and it's going to define the rest of the first administration of the new president.
Martin Kettle, Ewan McCaskill, thank you very much.
So how will this result be seen around the world? With me in London is our diplomatic editor, Julian Borgia.
This is obviously a result that's going to be welcomed in large parts of the world. If the world had voted instead of America, it would have been a huge landslide. So this gives the president-elect, soon to be President Obama, a big advantage on when he steps onto that stage. It will be like George Bush after the September 11 attacks, you know, a great reservoir of goodwill, but coming with it, high expectations.
The expectation that we'll now see an America that is not unilateralist in its approach and not exceptionalist, as in just putting America first over international laws and so on.
And that's an expectation that's likely to be met. I mean, that is the approach of the Obama team, the Obama foreign policy team, that America is no longer living in a unipolar world. There are several sources of power. It's multipolar. And that America needs to pursue a multilateral approach to adapt to that world.
And on climate change, one of the main issues affecting the world, Barack Obama, again, more progressive than McCain anyway, let's say.
Yeah, no, he supports cap and trade and mandatory limits on emissions, just like the Europeans. But he wants China and India to buy into those mandatory limits. And that's a negotiation that will have to be had over the course of next year, leading up to the Copenhagen summit due at the end of the year. But this result means that the possibility of negotiating a successor to the Kyoto Treaty that will work is now much greater.
And the election of a black American president, it affects the way that America is perceived around the world.
Enormously. This is transformational in the way that that America will be seen across much of the third world. And don't forget, this is a president whose middle name is Hussein. Now, that makes a lot of difference in the Islamic world, in the Arab world. So this is really, just in sheer terms of image and presentational terms, this is a huge difference.
Julian, thanks very much.
Well, that's it for our U.S. election edition of Guardian Daily. Look out for a special podcast later on today, Barack Obama, The Road to the White House, in which Jonathan Friedland traces Barack Obama's life story. Tomorrow's edition of Guardian Daily will also come from Washington, when Michael Tomasky and his team of experts and commentators will analyze in more detail what this result means for the country and the world. From John Dennis in London, and from me, Suzanne Goldenberg, and our team here in Washington, goodbye.
To reclaim the American dream and reaffirm that fundamental truth that out of many we are one, that while we breathe, we hope, and where we are met with cynicism and doubt and those who tell us that we can't, we will respond with that timeless creed that sums up the spirit of a people. Yes, we can. Thank you. God bless you, and may God bless the United States of America.